Today is May Day, International Workers' Day, and millions are in the streets worldwide to celebrate labor and fight against the exploitation inherent in the capitalist system. What makes the working class uniquely capable of solving the deep injustices that define our society?
We need a new system. We need a new society. We need to demand that which may have sounded impossible even a few weeks ago, but is not only realizable, but an imperative necessity.
We are very excited to have Professor Richard Wolff join us for a regular weekly segment where we discuss the biggest stories relating to the economy, the state of the working class, and the crimes of big business. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Beck. The Socialist Program brings you content several days a week thanks to the support of our patrons at patreon.com/thesocialistprogram. We appreciate all of your support and encourage you to become a patron today if you enjoy listening to the show. Richard Wolff is the co-founder of the organization Democracy at Work and the author of many books, the latest being The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. You can check out all of his work at rdwolff.com. So, Professor Wolff, since today is May Day, International Workers' Day, we wanted to have a bit of a more big picture conversation today about the working class. What makes the working class special? Why do people who desire a better, more just world look to the working class as the force in society that can bring about that transformation? Let me start by asking you a question. What does it mean when Marxists say that labor creates all value? Very essential, fundamental concept. Labor creates all value. What does that mean? Why is that true?
Well, there are a number of ways to respond to that, but all of them require that I ask your audience to do me an indulgence, if you would. Try to erase, just for a few moments, whatever you may have learned in school or on the TV or the web about economics. The so-called wisdom of economics, and I say that as a professor of economics all my life, that is mostly stuff designed to justify and rationalize the system we live in. It is not a useful vehicle for understanding what's going on. For that, you need basic common sense, and that's what I'm going to use now to try to answer the question you've asked. Why do Marxists, among others, believe that all value is produced by workers? So here we go. Think simply and you'll understand. If you look at any production process, whether it be to produce the ice cream cone you purchase at the corner candy store or the software program you buy from one of the giant technical companies or a ride on a subway or a pair of pants, whatever it is, here is what we know. That was produced, that good or that service was produced by human beings using their brains and their muscles to transform raw material of some kind, using a tool of some kind to make whatever the product is. So let's go with a pair of pants. There is a worker, probably several workers, who transform raw materials, cotton fiber, cotton textiles, polyester fiber into pants using a sewing machine and scissors and whatever else they need to get the job done. So we can see that the pants are clearly produced by labor. Well, you might ask, aren't they also produced by the scissors and by the sewing machine? You're right, they are. But then simply ask, who produced the sewing machine and who produced the scissors? You know what the answer is? Labor did that. didn't happen out of the air, didn't happen because people in management somewhere did it. It's because labor did it. Now let's look at the raw material, the cotton. Well, how did the cotton get to be in the factory where the pants are made? And again, the answer is labor. Labor planted the seeds. Labor harvested the cotton. Labor purified it, dyed it, prepared it to be made by other labor into the pair of pants. Bottom line is everything about that pair of pants or that ice cream cone or that software program was produced by labor. Labor in the past that produced the raw materials and the means of production, the tools, the equipment, the machines, and labor in the present that uses the machines to transform the raw materials into the finished product. Everything that is produced and has value in it in our economy was produced by, and therefore the labor was produced by, and therefore the value was produced by human beings using their brains and muscles to do the work. So the simple way of understanding it leads you then not only to understand that labor is the source of all value, but it leads you to ask the obvious question. If work, if labor produced all value, why are laborers not the owners of all the value that they produced? How did it come to be that the working class, the laborers, are the ones who own only a fraction of what they produced? And there are all these other people who are not laborers, who were not laborers, who own the fruits of the labor of other people. What happened here? The only reason some people can own wealth who didn't help to produce it, the only way that can happen is if the people who produced it did not get to keep what they had produced. There's no way out of this. This is elemental logic. So either way you look at it, there is something downright mysterious, and in a not good way, that explains the gap between rich and working class people, because the rich have what the workers produced, but what was not given back to the workers after they put the labor in to produce it. Instead, it was taken from them and passed over to the rich. That's why there is something fundamentally outrageous when a capitalist, an employer, says to the worker, "You get a wage for the work you do. I get a profit because I contribute the wealth. I own the machines. I own the raw material. I take the risk of putting them to work with your labor to produce output. So it's fair that you get paid a wage and I get paid a profit if I contribute money or machines, or I get rent if I contribute land." The worker smiles at this fakery. "Land," he says, "you get rent for land? Let me ask you, did you put the land there? Are you God?" "No, the land was there before you were there. The land wasn't put there by human beings. The land was already there when the human beings arrived. So where are you coming from telling me I should give you a part of the fruit of the labor of people because you've snatched a piece of the surface of this earth that you had no role in putting there?" And by the way, the same thing for the capitalists who offer the machines or the factories or the tools. The worker smiles and says, "How kind of you to offer. But you're offering what other workers produced. they should get the cut of the output that is responsible for or responds to what they contribute. Not you. You took it from them. You sit up there in your fancy office. You didn't make the tools and equipment and raw materials. You're snatching it, and you're snatching it, and you're trying to cover it by this nonsense about how workers contribute labor and get a wage, and capitalists contribute capital and get profits. What you've left out of that neat little story is the fact that the capital you contribute is the fruit of workers' labor and nothing else. That is the basic lesson that May Day ought to celebrate. And in much of the world, it does celebrate. And it means that the workers have the most profound justification for saying, since the workers are the source of all value, of all product, of all output, then if you divide up the output among the people who created it, it should be divided up among the people who do the work, not be shifted off to another group of people whose only claim to it is that they have means of snatching the value produced by workers and making it their own property instead.
Professor Wolf, extremely important points. You know, the term exploitation, I think commonly that's used to mean, well, workers who are paid really, really low, really unfairly low, you know, below what might be socially considered to be, you know, a just or a living wage. And of course, there are many, many workers who are paid, you know, outrageous poverty wages and are struggling to get that just a little bit higher so that they can survive. But when we walk through the step-by-step analysis, you know, where did value come from? Who made it? Who stole it? Who appropriated it? I mean, it becomes clear that actually every form of wage labor, if you are a worker who creates value for a boss who pays you a wage in return, something less than the value of what you create, you are being exploited. You are being stolen from. That's the very nature of production under this system. You mentioned the means to snatch it, right? You know, the bosses, the capitalists, they have the means to snatch the finished product of your labor, the land, the resources. Elaborate on that a little bit, if you will. I mean, how does the economic power that the capitalist class have rest on and also create political power?
Well, let me start by using your very notion of exploitation. You're quite right. One of the earliest basic points made in Karl Marx's great work, Capital, in Volume 1, where he defines exploitation. And he defines it as follows, and I'll explain. It's every situation in which the worker produces more value for the employer than the employer pays the worker to engage in the labor. And let me make it very personal and talk to each of you one-on-one, because you already know all this, even if you never read a word of Karl Marx. Here's how it works, and which is why you know it. You go looking for a job, maybe as a young person having finished high school or college. And you sit down with a prospective employer and you discuss a job. And the employer tells you, you know, what kind of work you'll have to do, where you'll sit, and what tools, if any, you'll be using, and when you're to show up, and when you have your lunch break, and all the rest. And then you come to that very crucial moment, pay. And the employer says to you, how about I pay you, and now let's take an example, $20 an hour. So you come here at 8 o'clock, you stay until 5, you have this kind of break, and you work over there. And at the end of the week, I'm going to give you $20 for each hour that you have devoted your brains and your muscle to whatever tasks I set to you in this place of business. Okay? You know something I'm about to explain, even though you may never have said it to yourself. Here's what you know. During that hour that you work, you are going to either produce more units of output for that employer than he would have had if he didn't hire you, or you're going to produce a different or better quality of output than he would have been able to sell if he didn't hire you. In other words, you're going to enhance the value of what your employer sells, whatever that good or service might be. So the employer's incentive in hiring you is because you increase the value of what that employer sells. All right, now take it one step with me. Suppose what you add in that hour is $20 worth of value. We then have a problem. The employer has a problem. He hires you. He pays you $20 for the hour. And he gets an extra $20 when he sells the fruit of your work. What's left then for the employer? The answer, nothing. There's nothing in it for the employer. And I'm going to tell you what you already know, that the employer is not going to do that. The employer is never going to do that. It's nothing personal. It's not that he likes or dislikes you. It's that that's not what business is about. Here's what business is about. You are paid less than what you add by your work. In the story I just finished, either the value you add has to be greater in some way, more skill you bring, more work you do, you work faster, something, or the employer is not going to pay you $20. The only way in a capitalist system the mass of working people get a job is because, and only to the extent, that they produce more value for the employer each hour than the employer pays them. And the difference between those two is what Marx called exploitation. Why? Because the worker is producing more than the worker is getting paid. The capitalist loves this, calls all of this profit, and wants us to think that the profit appears not because of what I just said, but because of something magical that the employer contributes, not his brains and muscle. Most employers of most business in this country are members of boards of directors. They have absolutely nothing to do with the company and the production of its commodities. They mostly know nothing about it. They buy and sell the company. They manipulate stocks. They do other things. But in the production of goods and services, they're irrelevant. So the profit doesn't come from what they do. The profit comes, as I just explained, because in our system, the employer can say to you, I'm only going to hire you up to this point. If you want more than that per hour, I'm not going to hire you because I got to get mine out of it. And mine is the difference between what I can get you to produce each hour in my workplace versus what I pay you for each hour. And that's, by the way, where capitalism arranges the snatching of means of production. Because look what I've just told you. In the process of producing, right in the core of it, as the worker works to produce the output, in that process, unbeknownst to the worker, something magical is going on. Wealth is being produced, but it is not going back to the worker. Let me do it again for you. If the worker produces $20 an hour of extra value by his or her labor, then the wage would have to be $20 if the worker is going to get back what the worker contributed. But that's exactly what never happens. Capitalism arranges it that the only way you're going to get a job earning $20 an hour is if the value of your labor is greater than that. And you know who gets the difference? The greater than? the one who gets what Marx called the surplus, those are the capitalists, not the workers who produced it, not the workers who did the work. No. The capitalists, the people in the position of employer who can run this scam on the rest of us. That's how they become wealthy. That's why it's so ironic as well as outrageous that having stolen the surplus from the people who produced it, they turn around and say, because I have the capital, I have the wealth that I stole earlier from you, I am entitled to now get a cut of the output. It really makes you take your hat off that a system as unjust as this could have arisen in the human community and could have lasted the last several centuries that it has, because it could not last another minute if people understood what we've just discussed in the last 15 minutes. Because if they did, they would not tolerate it. That's why so much effort is devoted. And why I began today's conversation by telling you that in the university where I work, we don't teach this. We're usually not allowed to. If you teach this way of thinking, you can kiss your career goodbye, in most cases. If I weren't a graduate of Harvard and Yale and all those places, the elite schools, I wouldn't be in the position of being a professor in an American university in all likelihood, and I probably would not have found my way to be talking to you this way at this moment. But I had the protection. I had the opportunity to learn what's going on. I understand why it isn't taught. Of course not. If you taught the American working class what I just went through with you, if they understood, they would be, and rightly so, utterly outraged that their grandparents and their parents and they themselves are subjected to this kind of exploitative system day in and day out. The only thing that makes this worse is the pretense of the people that run this society that it is, in some sense, democratic. Here's a little statistic that'll cure you of that delusion. According to the U.S. Census, 3% of Americans are employers. The rest of us aren't, which means 3% are playing the capitalist game and winning. They get the surplus. The rest of us, we produce the surplus for them and are asked to make believe that something other than that is going on.
Professor Wolf, I just have one more question before we wrap up this conversation. If a capitalist were listening to this discussion right now, he might have one last objection, which is basically that, well, we know how to run this thing. We know how to run the economy. We have the know-how, we went to the best schools, we have the best expertise, and well, you might not like all the decisions that we make, but what, are you workers, you ignorant workers, going to actually run the mechanisms of the economy? That's far too complicated. How would you respond to that? I mean, how can the working class actually take hold of what they produce and organize production without the dictatorship of the bosses?
Well, I think the first way to begin to answer that question is to remember what I said. If you are a small minority and you get the surplus into your hands, that extra, the difference between the value added by workers working versus the wage paid to them, then you'll understand that capitalists are always worried that somebody will understand and explain all of this the way Marx did and the way I'm trying to do now. So they're always defensive. They always have to come up with something, anything, that will make it reasonable or justified that they're doing what they're doing. If they can't use the argument, we have the capital because we've shown that that's what the fruit of other people's labor, you faker. If they can't use that, well, they have to find something else. And what you just articulated is one of those something else's. We have a special capability. In the university, this is called, you'll love this, entrepreneurship. that there's something going on special and unique in the brains and muscles of these rarefied members of our community that entitles them to snatch the surplus from the rest of us. Wow. The way to throw that out the window is to show that there are many examples where workers haven't done that. They haven't given the surplus to a small number of people. They haven't missed out on the leadership or entrepreneurship or specialized skills of anybody. Let me just give you one, and there are millions of examples. The seventh largest corporation in the country of Spain is called the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation. It has over 100,000 employees. That's why it's one of the biggest corporations in the whole country. It's a worker co-op. That is, in most of the businesses that it includes, and there's 200 or 300 businesses within this corporation, the workers are the owners of the business. The workers run the businesses. When they produce a surplus, which they do, it goes to themselves. They work as individuals, and they collect the surplus as a collective. The workers are their own bosses. The workers are their own board of directors. And guess what? They've done real well. The Mondragon Corporation was born in 1956, 6 workers and a Catholic priest. It's now over 100,000. It has outcompeted countless capitalist competitors along the way. It is roaringly successful. It works in the northern part of Spain mostly, which is better off than the rest of Spain. I could go on, but there is nothing other than self-delusion going on by imagining that there are all these specialized skills. If you actually work in a factory or an office, you will quickly learn over the bitter comments of your fellow workers during coffee breaks or lunch about how they had to correct a mistaken directive given by one of those bosses at the top, how they could, quote, teach the bosses something they don't understand about this system. They would remind you that many of the breakthroughs over the life of that corporation were made by workers at the bottom, workers in the middle. They will explain that it is just what it ever always was, an excuse to justify the fundamental injustice of the exploitation at the heart of the capitalist system.
Professor Wolf, we're going to have to leave it right there. Thank you so much for joining us. We were very excited to have Professor Richard Wolf join us. He's the co-founder of the organization Democracy at Work, the author of many books. The latest is The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. Go to rdwolf.com to check out all of his work. You've been listening to The Socialist Program. We bring you content several days a week thanks to the support of our patrons at patreon.com/thesocialistprogram. We appreciate all of your support and encourage you to become a patron today if you enjoy listening to the show.
You've been listening to The Socialist Program with Brian Becker, where we bring you news and views about the world for those who want to change it. If you enjoyed the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and watch video episodes of our in-depth show, The Real Story, every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on YouTube with our partner, Breakthrough News. We can only continue our work bringing you high-quality news, analysis, and history with the support of our listeners. Connect with us and become a patron at patreon.com/thesocialistprogram and receive an invitation to participate in an exclusive monthly seminar with Brian Becker.